Hi, I'm B.T. Newberg, and I'm here with Reverend Michael J. Dangler. Michael Dangler is the senior priest in Arnriach Fane, or ADF, which is a Druid organization. He is the Grove Priest of Three Cranes Grove in Columbus, Ohio. Thanks for being here.
No problem. Thank you for inviting me. I've been following the humanistic paganism stuff that you've been doing. I've been very impressed, and it's nice to have a chance to sit down with you and talk to you and meet you for the first time.
Thank you. And I actually, it's a special treat for me personally to be able to meet Michael Dangler in the flesh, face to face, because when I was starting out in ADF, which I'm also a member of ADF, Michael was one of the first to really give me encouragement along that path. So it's a good moment to say thank you.
It's important for us to make sure that we're supporting as many of our dedicants and members in general as possible. And it was always a pleasure to read the writings that you had and to be able to respond to them on kind of a personal level. And that's something that we hope to continue to do with all of our members. So,
what we're talking about today, our topic is the role of practice and belief in neo-pagan religion. Because it doesn't quite work out quite the same as the traditional idea of religion, for example, in mainstream Christianity or any of the other Abrahamic religions, such as Judaism or Islam. It's a little bit of a different take that tends to happen within the realm of neo-paganism. Which one gets more emphasis, practice or belief, and why? So that's what we're going to be talking about today. But first I want us to each share a little bit about who we are, what our path is. You know, you can also explain a little about what ADF is for listeners who are unfamiliar with that organization. Why don't you go ahead, Michael?
So, as you mentioned, I am one of ADF's senior priests, which means that I've been through the entirety of ADF's study program. And ADF is very based on study and ensuring that the practices that we do have some grounding in the reality of what the ancients did. ADF is a Druid organization.
With regard to the studying and making sure that we're faithful to the past, yeah, historical accuracy, is ADF then a kind of Celtic Reconstructionism where we're trying to do what the ancient Druids actually did?
As I was actually just getting to.
Oh, okay.
The ADF is not purely Celtic. We are pan-Indo-European. We kind of limited ourselves on the Indo-European front as a place to stop. So you will find people who are Celtic in nature as well as Norse or Roman or Greek or Vedic or Indo-Iranian even. So we run that entire spectrum of Indo-European languages. Looking back to these pre-Christian societies in Europe and trying to figure out what it was they did. Now, I like to call our religion not a reconstruction of those practices, but instead a reimagining. Mm. We like to start from the same place. We like to look at what those practices were, and we like to make them fit modern times. So, just because the ancients did it doesn't necessarily make it good enough for us. But by that same token, because they did it, clearly it worked. It's something that we should certainly reflect on. It's something that we should, if it does work for us, bring into our lives. But we are not at all tied to the way that ancient societies did these things. So, in a nutshell, I would say, that is kind of ADF. We are a pan-Indo-European reimagining of the ancient world for modern folk.
One of the ways that I think that I read Isaac Bonowitz talked about it, which Isaac was the founder of ADF, was that the idea was to use the same symbols and motifs as people in the ancient worlds or those ancient Indo-European cultures, but a modern liturgy and style of ritual that makes sense to us. So that if someone from the ancient world were to somehow be transported to our time, they would recognize at least some of the symbols and motifs as being in common, even if they don't know exactly what's going on in the ritual.
Indeed. It would be even if we were to try and reconstruct everything exactly, there are still going to be holes that we would have to fill in, and a person transported to our modern age would not really know what the heck was going on for most of it. But by that same token, we do think that someone who has worked in this path as you know, it ran in their life's blood, and they did this every day, and they were an ancient pagan person, if they came to one of our rituals, they would probably recognize a good amount of it as something that is familiar to them, and not something that is completely foreign.
Right. So. Right. Cool. And a little bit about myself. B.T. Newberg, I am the editor of Humanistic Paganism, and I've been a member of ADF as well for, gosh, it must be about 6 years now, something like that. Maybe less. But in any case, it was one of the organizations that I found where I felt like there was a lot of level heads among the members. I definitely didn't always believe the same way that other people did, but it didn't end up being much of a problem. And that was something that I always valued about ADF. ADF, I think, the more mainstream idea within that organization is a polytheism, oftentimes a literal polytheism, but I went into it as an agnostic, saying, hey, I'm an agnostic, you know, can I be a member of ADF? And what I usually encountered was something that I like to call confused acceptance, where I was accepted, but people didn't really understand what I got out of ADF if I didn't really believe in it, or what I got out of the rituals, but that was okay. I was more than just tolerated, I was accepted. And so I found that very valuable and very interesting as an aspect of the ADF organization.
Yeah, it's one of those things where, you know, we're more than happy to accept anyone who comes along. What they get out of it is really up to them. For a lot of ADF members, you know, we're not trying to push an experience down someone's throat. We don't expect everyone to experience the same thing, which is different than a lot of other religions out there.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, we expect those people to, you know, if they're a dues-paying member, then we would expect that they would be interested in at least doing the things that we do, which
right.
I think is probably exactly what you want to talk about.
So. Yeah, and I think it does. Yeah, I think it does go a little bit deeper even than what we've said so far. The idea of non-dogma is a real value, I find, in ADF, and practice is highly valued, whereas belief can be a bit ambiguous, or various different beliefs can be tolerated. And yeah, that's the theme of today. So what I want to start off with, taking the recommendation of a guy named Chris Stedman, who I recently interviewed, he is actually an atheist interfaith activist, is how he describes himself, which is interesting in itself. But one of the things that he recommended in doing any interfaith work is to start with stories, because that way you're always coming, you're just talking about your own experience, and the other person is free to listen without feeling attacked, and vice versa. It's just a safe way to start, and you begin to empathize. So let's start with a story. If we could each share some kind of experience, a personal experience, that maybe illustrates sort of the role of practice and belief in your path, in our paths. Is there something like that comes to mind that you might share?
There is. It's actually kind of a combination of two things. The first is a set of daily devotionals that I do, sunrise and sunset, and now within about the past month, I've also started looking at moonrise for another reason, but that's slightly outside the context of this. But when I was doing some of my study work to become a clergy person in ADF, what I found was that I didn't have a practice that was consistent, that happened every day the same way, and that had real meaning to me. And so what I did was I wrote a couple of prayers, one to the goddess of the dawn and one to the goddess of the night, and I decided I was going to say one at dawn and one at sunset every day, regardless of when sunset and sunrise actually occurred, because they shift as the year goes on. I think it's a 2-hour, 3-hour swing. I forget what it is off the top of my head.
Depending on where you are in the northern hemisphere or southern.
Yes, and it gets complicated as you move from place to place.
Right.
And as I go to festivals across, you know, the United States, I'm suddenly doing things much earlier in the morning or much later at night. But what I did was I had never worked with Vedic deity before. And I'd
and
heard a lot
what's
of...
What's a Vedic deity?
A Vedic deity is a deity you'll most often find them associated with Hinduism. It's a deity found in the Rig Veda. And the Rig Veda is a set of hymns. It's the foundational document of Hinduism. But not all the deities in Hinduism show up in the Rig Veda. Not all the deities in the Rig Veda show up fully in Hinduism or look the same once they reach Hinduism. But it's a Vedism is an Indo-European religion out of India or Afghanistan, somewhere in that area, that really focuses on the order of the worlds. And in it, in Vedism, priests are kind of the top level of the hierarchy as well. So there's a lot of that focus on the religious work. And there's some beautiful hymns. And my favorites are the ones to the goddess Ushas, who's the goddess of the dawn. Coming in a close second is the hymn to the goddess Ratri, who's the goddess of night, Ushas's twin sister. And so what I did was I took these Vedic hymns and things that had been written about Ushas and Ratri, and I kind of put them together and built a small, I think, 7-line prayer for the dawn and an 8-line prayer for Ratri, the night. And I started doing devotionals. And the thing that really stuck out to me first was that I was starting to build a connection. And it wasn't a connection of, you know, the goddess picking me up and hitting me over the head with a 2x4 and saying, hey, now you need to believe in me. It was just this response of, oh, someone's taking notice and someone's doing work. And, you know, I wasn't doing a full-blown Vedic ritual at dawn. I was saying 7 lines. I wasn't doing a full-blown Vedic ritual at night. I was saying 8 lines, I think it is. And as I did this, I started to understand these deities better and better. Even though it was the exact same lines mm-hmm. every night. Mm-hmm. I wasn't altering them, I wasn't changing my my routine at all, but I was getting closer, and I was feeling more from them, and it was all based on the practice. Additionally, what I found with Ushas specifically was that the relationship that I started to build with that particular goddess became more and more real and lifelike. And it's not, in ADF we have what we call patronage, which is a relationship that is where, that is more than the usual reciprocal relationship. It's more than I have given you gifts, you give me blessings in turn. It is, I give you what I can, and what you return to me is far more than I could ever possibly expect from what I've given.
Mm-hmm.
It's that benefactor who sits out there and takes care of you.
Right.
And so I started to have this relationship with Ushas, but it wasn't like that benefactor-patron relationship. It was really just like a relationship of appreciation.
Mm-hmm.
And the more I read and the more I did this work, the deeper that got. And then the other interesting thing that happened with this is that it started to really change my outlook on things. For instance, I could no longer go to movies that started at 7:30 because it would overlap with the time that the sun went down. And so it really changed my social life as well in ways that I really couldn't fathom beforehand. And this was only supposed to be a 4-month experiment, and it's turned into 6 years, I guess, or something like that. It's been a very long time, and it's been inconvenient, and sometimes I don't do it as often as I did, but there's a feeling of home with that practice that I really, really like. It makes me feel whole. It makes me feel that I'm appreciated as well as my appreciation for the goddess. You know, it's a wonderful cycle. And a couple of years ago, when I was I flew out to Greece, which was another set of deities that I'd never worked with. I was I was out in Greece with a bunch of friends, and we toured all the archaeological sites. I did there's a common meditation in ADF called the Two Powers Meditation, and I did this Two Powers Meditation with one of my co-conspirators, Via. She and I would go to weird places and do Two Powers Meditations.
Okay.
And the Two Powers Meditation is where you call it the power of the earth and the power of the sky and kind of let it flow through you.
Mm-hmm.
And
very common theme among different
extremely
neo-pagan paths, yeah.
And so we did this at various temples. So we did this at the Temple of Poseidon in Sunia. We did this at the Temple of Apollo in Delphi. We actually, there's a way you can get under the Temple of Apollo. And so we went down there avoiding the guards who were watching. Because I don't think you're supposed to go down there, but they didn't tell us we couldn't. There was no sign. But we went underneath and we did it down there. And we went to the volcano where Hephaestus is said to reside and went into the crater.
The god Hephaestus.
Yes, the god Hephaestus. Went into the crater and did it there, and it was a different experience every time. We're doing the same practice and getting different results in the ways that our bodies kind of react and how we feel, and that was very eye-opening. But possibly the most eye-opening part really was when I stood on the slopes of Mount Olympus. Because we were driving up, you can drive about halfway up Mount Olympus to a parking lot. And as we were driving up, the sun was just coming up over the Mediterranean, because Olympus is right on the sea there. And I watched it. I watched the dawn come up and the bright pink sky flow out from that point on the horizon where you know the sun is going to come all the way out. The Vedics describe it as the cows going down to the water after the gates of heaven have been opened. And at that moment, standing on Mount Olympus, where just, you know, 5 days earlier I'd gotten lost and prayed to Zeus to get me off the mountain. And he had responded with eagles in the sky and all sorts of cool stuff. But there I am standing on Mount Olympus, the center of Greek religion, and I am experiencing Ushis, the Vedic goddess of dawn.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very, very powerful to me. So that's kind of one of those things that when I think of practice, that's the thing that I think of, are those dawn and those evening devotionals that have brought that kind of real value to the work that I do.
So how would you say that those practices interrelate with belief for you?
Well, that's an interesting question. And what I have what I've learned over the years of doing all of these practices and trying out new ones that sometimes work and sometimes don't, is that in my mind, practice begets belief. As you do these things, as you you know, every time you light your candle and say a prayer over that flame, because a sacred fire should always be kindled in prayer, or a song or something like that, I feel it doing that suddenly makes that act sacred. And as you do these things, you start to understand the belief in your own mind, not necessarily a belief that someone else has said you should hold, but a belief that really makes sense to you on a visceral level, something that sits in your heart and that you feel rather than something that you know. And it can translate into something that you know as well. You know, you can start to articulate that, as we're doing now. And you can start to explain what those beliefs are. But the key to it, I've always thought, is doing the practice. And as you do those practices, the beliefs will build and mm-hmm. change and transform and really kind of create the way that you look at the world. And that, I think, is really the connection between practice and belief. And practice can get you through rough times. If you are having trouble finding that belief, if you're not sure there's anyone out there listening, mm-hmm. the best thing to do is, in my opinion, is to continue what you're doing. Because the belief that you or the belief that you seek will appear as you do the practice. Mm-hmm. You will start to feel it again. And it's okay, I tend to think. A lot of people don't like doing don't like it when they're going through the motions. Mm-hmm. You know, when there's nothing attached to
what it can feel like when you're starting out, right?
And it certainly does. It almost always feels like you're just going through motions, and then it doesn't really matter, and that no one's ever gonna, you know, pay attention to what you're doing. And it can feel like that for weeks or months or mere hours, you know, depending on how you kind of interact and whether it's all working. And sometimes it feels like a brick wall. But the more you do it and the deeper you get into it and the more often and the more consistent you are with your practice, then the more likely you are to start getting those feelings and having those beliefs. And the practice will eventually start to reflect the beliefs that you're putting out there. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, interesting. I think the tidbit that I'd like to snatch on from there is when you said practice begets belief. I think that's very telling, particularly of the unique attitude, somewhat unique attitude in neo-paganism, because that's kind of reverses the order that is often traditionally thought of, especially in a classical monotheist sense, where belief is given top priority and then the practice kind of follows from the beliefs. But it's the other way around in modern neo-paganism. And they were not necessarily closely connected in ancient paganism either, although that's a whole topic in and of itself that we don't necessarily need to get into. But I think that's very telling. Yeah, thank you for sharing that story. So that's an example, it sounds like, of where practice and belief mutually reinforce each other. Mm-hmm. The one leads to the other, and the other kind of amplifies and supports the other. In my case, I've had that experience too, definitely. When I started out, the practices were just, as you said, they felt like I'm just kind of going through the motions, I'm just trying to get started, didn't really feel anything to start with. But as I went along and as it became more and more of a something that's important to me, and as I did the same things over and over again, like you saying that you were saying the same seven lines or eight lines or whatever it was, mm-hmm. But yet you were deepening in the meaning that it had for you. As I did that, it felt like it built this kind of like resonance, so that every time that I did a given ritual, it would sort of, in a Pavlovian association sort of way, bring up those previous experiences, and it would kind of tend to reverberate and have this very visceral meaning for me. Not a meaning that's rational, that you can explain, but a meaning in terms of a value and a feeling that you feel within yourself that is valued. And so I can really see that. At the same time, the story that I want to tell is of something not so much where belief and practice integrate so well, but where they kind of disintegrate. When I went into ADF, let me just start off by saying I was agnostic, and I've been agnostic about existence of gods, about efficacy of magic, about all these things the whole way through, but on different ends of the spectrum sometime. I slide around a bit. And as I was going through ADF, I was exposed to these new ideas of polytheism and thinking of the gods as if they really are out there in some sense. And I don't know if I ever really completely accepted that, but I certainly gave it a chance. I fully and completely, I think I can confidently say that I gave it a very good chance, you know? And I started getting good results with that. And what I mean by results is sort of a fulfilling feeling. It's specifically a feeling that I had, a fulfilling and meaningful feeling that I had in doing rituals to certain goddesses. In my case, Demeter, the goddess of grain, Isis, who's an Egyptian goddess, who doesn't, not Indo-European, but it was something that was a holdover from my earlier days, and she's always been my first and foremost. In any case, as I was going through it, I started having this real sense of meaningful interaction going on. And when I was specifically in the ritual, I was able to sort of have this suspension of disbelief, much as when you're in a really engrossing movie, where you don't really, I mean, the rational mind is temporarily, it's still there and functioning in the background, but it's not something that's the most important thing on your mind is to figure out exactly rationally what's going on right now. What's the most important thing on your mind is the experience and how you're experiencing it. That's how it was for me. And in ritual, it was to that certain extent as if the gods were real. But as soon as I would leave ritual, and then a few hours later or the next day, then I would start thinking about it and thinking about how I felt. And I felt a conflict, a sort of cognitive dissonance, and a sort of almost a bit of guilt and shame about how could I be so gullible and think that, oh, that God was really present there, even though, as I said, I was agnostic. I didn't really think that, but I felt that, you know, so there was this real difference between what I was feeling and valuing within ritual, and that's the practice part, because it was feelings that came along with doing. A sort of a conflict between that and then thinking about it, and what do I really believe about what happened during that ritual? Or what do I really believe about what is true about how the universe is or how it works? And so there was a real cognitive dissonance there. And for a long time, I couldn't quite work it out because I felt like, no, for me, no disrespect to other people out there who believe differently than me, but just speaking for me, I couldn't really accept rationally the idea of like literal gods being outside of my mind and just existing out there somewhere. It just didn't function for me. But at the same time, this polytheist organization, ADF, and its rituals, and believing as if they were real during ritual, was really working for me. So I was like, this is working, but why? So it was only gradually, after a lot of kind of wavering, that I came to a realization that you can have different states of mind. The human mind, even though it's constantly working to integrate, it's built to hypothesize and think of different possible explanations, entertain different possible explanations at different moments. And during ritual, you can have that suspension of disbelief and to behave and think and feel as if these entities are real. And then that conjures up a certain experience that is valuable. And then when you leave ritual and you approach it from a different mind state and from within a different framework of explanation, that you can have a different idea about how what's really real in the universe. Maybe these gods are really, you know, biological responses to the way they're, you know, something about the paternal image of having a mother figure as a goddess or a father figure as a god. And this is calling up something psychological within me, but at this, there's something about that where you can have both of those different explanations where you're just looking at the same thing from different points of view, and that's okay. Yeah. And you don't ultimately have to decide one or the other. I mean, you kind of find out where the balance is for you, and it's going to be different for different people. But for me, it took a while. It took a while to find that sort of bridge that allowed me to entertain multiple viewpoints, multiple frames of mind and explanation about what's going on as I go through my spiritual practices, and to be okay with that. And it also, let me say also, that coming to that realization has also helped me with being tolerant toward other people's points of view. And I'm very comfortable with polytheists, with traditional classical monotheists, with atheists, with, you know, the whole spectrum. And so that's something that's where practice and belief has really led to a real interrogation of what do I really believe and what is really valuable in my life. It came out in a particular way, which had to do with the goddess Persephone. Persephone has been kind of important as I go through the seasons, because her story of descending to the underworld and rising back again mirrors the barren season that comes in the season of the year, as well as the fertile season. In any case, there was one point where I had a pendant that I was wearing around my neck, and I decided that I was going to wear this pendant for the whole time that she was above the in the above world, not in the underworld, as a devotion to her. But then at the point in the season, which for me, I was recognizing it as summer solstice, then I was going to bury that pendant in the ground as a devotion to her. Just as she goes into the underworld, this pendant's going to go down into the ground. And that became, that's another one of those practices. It's something I'm actually doing with my hands, and it's interesting that, you know, I'm not just thinking about it, it's something I'm doing with my hands, and that really triggered something in me. Something meaningful came out of that. When I was doing the specific summer ritual, summer solstice ritual, where I was going to bury the pendant, and at the moment in the ritual, when I actually did the burying, I felt something sort of crack open within me, or a realization sort of flash across my mind or my heart, I guess you could say, where I really realized, no, the polytheism isn't what I believe. I really believe in a more naturalistic point of view. But at the same time, I thought about it in the sense of Persephone has killed the gods for me, which is a mythic way of explaining it.
Yeah.
And to me, that was valuable. It kind of integrated the two, because I was using both stories in the same idea. And that, so that there was fallout for in my spiritual life after that. I kind of moved away from ADF, went to humanism and things, but I felt that after being in humanism for a short while, I felt like I missed some of the fulfilling practices that I had in ADF, and I went back to it. And then at that point, I felt like the gods came back to life within a naturalistic point of view. But just as Persephone dies and rises, goes down to the underworld and comes back up again, so she killed the gods for me and brought them back to life. And when I explain it in those two different ways, as either rationally the way I believe about things, as opposed to this mythic story of how I believe about it, it has a totally different resonance and a different meaning in the way I feel when I explain it. And I think that that really expresses the role of practice and belief in my case. Practice really, it conjures up something that's so much more visceral than just contemplating or just thinking or rationally explaining what you believe. But when you actually do the practices, it begets belief.
Yeah.
And in some cases, it'll beget naturalistic beliefs for some people and polytheistic beliefs for others. But you find out, or maybe even create or co-create, what you're going to believe from that point on until another thing changes in your life.
The one of the things that is always worth pointing out is that you know, practice is something that you physically do. And there are plenty of studies out there that show that standing or sitting or kneeling or making certain movements will cause similar reactions, will cause people to feel in similar ways whenever they do them. So regardless of what the person is thinking, when they do those things, they get these feelings. And we describe those feelings as religious feelings very often.
Mm-hmm.
Whether they are actually religious or not is a whole other can of worms. But, you know, as we go through these things, we do recognize that religion is tied to the way the body functions. And if you sit in a certain way, you're going to have experiences that mirror other people who sit in certain ways, too. And so there's that aspect, too, I think, that we need to recognize when we talk about practice versus belief, is that it really can truly beget a belief, and a shared belief at that, when you do the same things that others do.
Yeah, I've definitely read studies like that, too. And, I mean, it mirrors my experience very well, which you just explained. So we're coming up on time, but before we go, I'd like to just get your input on what you think about this sort of emphasis on practice within neo-paganism, as opposed to having belief as the priority, and what that might contribute to the religious landscape in the West in the future, in the 21st century.
Well, as you know, ADF has what we call a core order of ritual. All of our rituals kind of follow the same order. They all do similar things at similar times. And then they've got little assumptions built into them. And these assumptions, I think, are what take the place of belief in most pagan religions. And so I like to call them ritual assumptions.
Okay.
These are things that the ritual is kind of built around. So in ADF's case, there's this idea of hard polytheism, where you have a variety of gods and goddesses out there, and spirits and ancestors, and it's a whole host of spirits, and you treat them all as individuals, as if they have their own personality, as if they can respond to gifts and provide us with blessings in return. These kinds of things are just a basic assumption. The same thing with three realms. We have we describe the cosmos as being divided into three pieces, or three parts, if you will. Usually a land, sea, sky, or an underworld, middle world, upper world. And then there's the ability to move between these worlds is another ritual assumption. The fact that things spoken here at the center will be heard at the fringes of the cosmos.
Mm-hmm. Now these are assumptions,
these
not
are all
dogmas
assumptions.
And not requirements.
Absolutely. These are the assumptions that the ritual structure is built around.
Right.
So you can do an ADF ritual and not have any specific ADF belief, if we could even say there really is an ADF belief, but you can go through the motions, and essentially you're assuming when you do an ADF ritual that these assumptions cause the ADF ritual to work. You can contact an individual spirit and honor it and receive blessings in turn. It will be able to talk to you. You can have a geography. And these are all based on the practice that we have, not on, the earth is three parts or four, it's one, there's a dwarf in each of the four directions holding up the middle world.
Right.
You know, we don't say that, and we don't force you to believe that, but the ritual kind of makes it so. We don't force you to believe, or we don't expect you even really to believe that, yes, there's a single deity out there called Persephone.
Mm-hmm.
And Persephone is one of a variety of Olympian gods who sit up at the throne of Zeus on Olympus and make decisions for mortals. You know, we don't expect you to believe that, but we do expect you to treat Persephone as an individual that you can work with. Otherwise,
right.
The ritual itself
right.
doesn't make a lot of sense.
I like to think of it as similar to the rules of a game. I mean, you
yeah.
can have a certain debate outside of basketball about the virtue of certain rules, but if you're going to play basketball, you have to agree on the rules, and
absolutely.
That's what makes it basketball.
There's a guy who, and I may butcher his name, he's I think Dutch, John Huizinga. who wrote on play.
Yep.
And essentially what he talks about is that when you're engaged in play, you know, whether it's a baseball game or basketball game or a ritual, what you are doing is you are living within the bounds of a set of rules, really. And as you do that, you can advance in the game, and you know, you can win, you can lose, that kind of thing. But the game has meaning while you are in the game, because you agree to these rules and because you follow them. If you, and you can bend or slightly break the rules, that's okay. There are functions, there are things in the game that deal with that. In basketball or baseball, there are umpires and referees who are also part of the game, who enforce those rules. They put people in penalty boxes, for instance.
But the walls of the cosmos do not come crumbling down when somebody breaks the rules.
Exactly. And but unless someone breaks them so badly, for instance, the guy a couple of years ago who tried to catch a ball at a Cubs game and supposedly cost the Cubs their chance at the World Series, that brought the game down. I mean, it just the Cubs fans were all in an uproar. And interestingly, the way that they resolved all of that was they took that ball and they sacrificed it. The ball was destroyed. So it was ritually taken apart at, I think, Harry Carey's in Chicago and just completely destroyed.
They dismantled the physical ball as a gesture of saying this isn't okay.
There's a very good article, and I think it's actually free on the internet if you look it up, about how this was carried out. So, you know, you can use ritual, you know, and you can replace all those assumptions, and you can fix a problem that happened in another ritual, too. So, you know, even if it does break down fully, you can still fix it that way.
So what do you feel all of this has to do with contributing to the religious landscape of our society?
I think the key thing is that when we're able to accept that there are assumptions in ritual, that it's not black and white, that it's not all hot or all cold, there's a lukewarm option, or there's a there's a gray, where not everyone has to believe as I do. You know, we can all get along just fine, and we can all work toward the common good. Paganism is a civic religion. It's a religion about being in the community. And it doesn't matter what another person believes. It doesn't matter what kinds of gods they believe in. It doesn't matter if they don't believe in any. What matters to pagans, ancient or modern, is that you do the work, that you walk your walk.
Not but not in an empty way, but in the sense where the doing the work begets the meaning of it.
Indeed, yes. It's definitely not an empty thing, because as you said, it doesn't matter if you believe it. Sometimes just doing it is a very powerful thing. I went to vote just a couple of days ago, and voting is to me something that I think everyone should do. It's part of our civic duty as participants in democracy to go out and vote. I don't care who you vote for. I just care that you went out and voted.
Right.
And that is really kind of the essence
right.
of how we sort of look at religion as pagans. Is we kind of look at it and we say, oh, you know, you went in and, you know, you went through the process and you got something out of it. Great. That's exactly what we wanted.
Right.
And when we talk about our democracy, all that we really want people to do is go out and vote.
Right.
When people get mad at other people for not voting in a certain way, that's where the troubles start.
Right.
I mean, you can see it right now in the way that our society is becoming more and more segregated based on how they vote, you know? And that is troubling to me. But what's important to me is that these people are going out and voting. I don't care who they vote for. As long as we're still allowed to go out, cast our ballots, and do our civic duty. And I think that's one of the key things that can help the world that we live in, is this understanding that really it's about the actions that you do, taking responsibility to do those actions, and following through with them in a healthy and productive way.
So there's a certain sense in which this relationship between practice and belief, which is prevalent in neo-paganism, sort of reflects and reinforces the value and the values in a democratic society.
Yes, very much. I think so. It was in the ancient world, you were not allowed to pray silently at the altar. The idea was that, you know, anything you would say at the altar, you could say to everybody. And if you couldn't say it to everybody, you were probably doing dark magic, and shame on you.
Now, this is in Greece, Rome.
Greece and Rome, yeah. I think it was specifically outlawed in Rome.
Okay.
I wish I could remember the citation.
Okay.
But there is a source that I read at one point which indicated that should you pray silently at your altar, then that is not allowed. So it was really about everyone coming up and speaking.
Uh-huh.
And doing their civic duty to the gods and goddesses. Whether or not they believed in them was not an issue. It was really all about doing the duty that you've been called to do, mm-hmm. as a member of that society.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I'm not going to say, obviously, that we should all go out and worship our societal gods.
Everybody should salute the flag, whether you like it or not.
Yeah,
not quite the same idea, right?
On the other hand, you know, maybe we should all be making offerings to democracy and liberty.
Right.
I can't see anyone who would disagree with that, but there might be someone. But you know, it would be nice, you know, if we didn't have this way of looking down on practice, because a lot of times we do look down on people who go through the motions. And that comes from, I think, this idea that belief is more important than the work that is done. And I think that really, if you're going to judge someone, don't judge them by what they say they believe, judge them by what they do.
Hmm.
Because that's something that actually has meaning in the world. I don't really think that belief, especially closely guarded belief or belief that isn't backed up by practice, has as much meaning as practice. So if you believe that you should be donating more to the food bank, that's great. But until you actually write a check to the food bank or take food down there, mm-hmm. you haven't done anything.
Yeah.
So I think it's very important that, you know, we not overlook the importance of practice. That we not overlook it and assume that belief can somehow trump it. Because
mm-hmm.
I don't think that it can. And I don't think that practice can necessarily trump belief either.
Right.
But I think that, like I said, if you're going to have one or the other, it is far better to walk the walk than it is to talk the talk.
Excellent. Nice way to sum it up, too. So, thank you. We're out of time. But I'd like to thank my guest, Michael J. Dangler. He's a reverend in Armagnac fame, ADF, Druid organization, the Grove priest of Three Cranes Grove in Columbus, Ohio. You can find him online, I'm sure, by Googling Michael J. Dangler.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm B.T. Newberg, editor of Humanistic Paganism. You can also find me at humanisticpaganism.com. Thank you for being here, Michael.
Well, thank you for having the idea to sit down and have a real formal chat.
I had a great time, and I was really happy to finally meet you face-to-face.
And I was happy to meet you face-to-face as well.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.